All right. Do you like where you live? Have you thought about moving to a place that's safe, with a good transportation system, in a good school district, and here's the kicker, is affordable? All right, you can wake up now. Time to stop daydreaming. Welcome to The Full Story on WSHU and online at WSHU.org. I'm Ron Ripiak. I know. Some of you are saying, what are you thinking, Ron? Because what you describe is nirvana, not reality. It's the affordable component that really upsets the apple cart. And that's going to be our discussion today. What should be done to get us more affordable housing in our region, or is it just a pipe dream? You can always join in the conversation. Our email is tfs@wshu.org, or check us out on Facebook. We're at Full Story WSHU. We're going to start our program today by bringing in Fred Thiel. Fred is a New York State Assemblyman out of Sag Harbor. Assemblyman Thiel, always good to speak with you, sir. How are you?
Hi, Ron. How are you this afternoon?
I'm fine, thank you. So what do you think? Affordable housing? A pipe dream at this point?
I don't think it's a pipe dream. I think it's one of the most difficult issues, certainly, that we face here on the east end of Long Island. Because of the marketplace, affordability for people that want to stay here local, whether they be young families or older residents that are trying to stay in the community. And I think it's going to require substantial thinking outside of the box to come up with alternatives and initiatives to help make housing more affordable. But I think it's certainly something that we're, with a number of initiatives, we might be able to change the dynamics as far as affordable housing goes.
Okay. Now, I know you're concentrating on the East End because that's who you represent, but in reality, this is pretty much the same across our region, right?
I think it's across the region. I think because on the East End, there's such competition for housing from people that want a second home that it makes it more difficult for those who live on the East End who are trying to buy a first home. But clearly, if you look particularly at the U.S. Census numbers, what you will see is that while the population of Long Island is relatively stable or slightly increasing, when it comes to the demographic of those that are in their 20s and their 30s and their 40s, we are losing population. One of the reasons why we're losing population is the affordability of housing.
Now, here's the thing, Assemblyman. I worked for Connecticut Public Television for many years, and I'm telling you, I could take a report that I did 30 years ago about this issue, and I could play it back today, and I'm, except for a few different names here and there, it's pretty much the same report. There hasn't been the change that I anticipated that it might be, 30 years ago, that something would have been done. Is my observation correct? Are we simply hearing more of the same old, same old?
I think your observation is largely correct. I took a report that my office did about 15 years ago on affordable housing with a proposal in it for a community housing fund. And that's a bill that I'd like to talk about that we actually passed this year. But the recommendations, the situation 15 years ago was the same as it was this year. The only difference was is that this year in the state legislature, there was the political will to create an opportunity for the five East End towns out here, South Hold, Riverhead, Shelter Island, East Hampton, and Southampton. We passed a bill that would allow each of them to establish a dedicated housing fund that would be funded by a 0.25% tax on real estate transfers over $400,000. So it's the same issue. It has been for a while, but at least we have this one initiative that would generate about $20 million for affordable housing, whether it be the construction of new housing, construction of rental housing, financial assistance for first-time home buyers. So yes, the issue has been, consistent, but I do sense, because we had this proposal for several years and we got opposition, certainly from the real estate industry, who didn't want to see a tax. But, you know, the amount of support for affordable housing, you know, I think has reached a critical mass. And that's what allowed us to pass this bill in the legislature this year. Now, it still requires the governor to sign it, and he'll be taking action on it in the fall. But I'm optimistic that it will be signed by the governor, and this will provide some new resources for at least for the local governments out here. And I guess, you know, we were the first to have a community preservation fund for land preservation, and then it spread across the state. I think we're hoping something similar will happen with the community housing fund.
Okay, so this is a step in the right direction, but is there a bold plan, a big plan that you were talking about before, a visionary plan?
Well, I don't think there's a silver bullet. I don't think there's one initiative. I think we have to do a series of things. You know, a community housing fund certainly changes the dynamic substantially and would provide housing opportunities for many, many more people than local governments are able to do now. You know, a second initiative that we had this year was providing protections for mobile homes, manufactured homes, from rent gouging. A lot of senior citizens, in particular, live on Long Island, live in a manufactured home park or a mobile home park, and they have been at the mercy of rent gouging for years. That has been made it difficult for them to stay on Long Island. We passed a bill which was part of an overall housing bill that the legislature passed this year that included rent control in the city of New York, but it also included protections for manufactured housing. So I think, you know, we know what the demand is. We know what the problem is. You know, through things such as a community housing fund or protections for manufactured home tenants, these are ways, I think, that, you know, one step at a time, we can reverse the trend on the lack of affordable housing.
Assemblyman, some have said that we may simply have to think out of the box and simply expand the region. So if you want to work at a desirable spot, fine, but you're going to have to live maybe far away and you're going to have to commute more, whether in the car or on the train, or figure out a way to telecommute for that job.
I don't think there's any question about that also, and that certainly is something that we see on the East End. Many people, you know, unemployment, I should say, on the East End is virtually non-existent between the trades and, you know, the service industry. We have jobs, you know, professional jobs, teachers, the local hospital, nurses, doctors, but many people can't afford to live here. So I agree with you that not just providing or trying to tip the balance on having housing opportunities, but the other thing that is important and is part of this is also transportation. And that is why, you know, from my perspective, you know, housing and public transportation work together. And at the same time, we're talking about community housing funds and protecting manufactured home tenants. We're also talking about expanding public transit. And one of the great successes that we've had on Eastern Long Island over the last 6 months is that 6 months ago in March on the South Fork, we began what was called the South Fork Commuter Connection, so that those people that are coming from Brookhaven or Points West who work on the East End can pick up a train in Spionk or West Hampton or Hampton Bays in the morning and get to their job on the South Fork. We're also providing bus service to get them from the train station to their jobs. And we added two trains during the rush hour in the morning that head eastbound and two trains in the afternoon that head westbound. And thus far, it's been a substantial success. The ridership, the amount of tickets that the Long Island Railroad has sold on those South Fork stations have more than doubled since we've initiated this service. So people are using it. People like it. The only complaint I get about the new commuter service is that there's not enough of it. And we only have one track here on the South Fork, so we have to make some infrastructure improvements so that trains can pass each other. But, you know, we've got that in the capital plan so that, you know, within a couple of years we'll have made those improvements. So, you know, smart growth, I think, is the term that people use, and that involves not just providing housing for a balanced housing policy, but it has to include things such as transportation. So improved public transit on the East End, improved housing opportunities, and then I think, you know, you're talking about a plan that's sustainable for the future, where we're getting people out of their cars, we're getting people to use trains, we're providing more housing opportunities for people closer to where they want to work. And, you know, I think the community overall will benefit from that.
Assemblyman, we're just about out of time. Maybe we can get you back soon and we could tackle this one. A lot of people say, sure, more affordable housing is great, but put it over there. Don't put it in my community because I don't want my property values to go down. But that's, I think, going to be a topic and a discussion for a whole segment next time you and I get together.
Yeah, well, glad to do it. And thank you for having me, and thanks for the opportunity to talk about some of these initiatives that are going on the East End.
Fred Thiel, who's the New York State Assemblyman out of Sag Harbor. Thanks, Assemblyman. We always appreciate your time.
Thank you.
We're talking affordable housing in our region, and we have two guests for you this next segment. Sean Guillo is Policy Director at the Partnership for Strong Communities, an advocacy group that lobbies for more affordable housing. Hey, Sean, nice to meet you.
Thanks for having me, Ron.
And Steve Mazzacane is the owner and editor of Brantford7.com. Hi, Steve. Welcome.
How are you? Thanks for having me on.
It's our pleasure. Sean, I'd like to start with you. Give us a quick background on your group, please.
Sure. A Partnership for Strong Communities is a statewide housing and homelessness advocacy organization. Been around for about 20 years, advocating for policies to end homelessness at the state level and expand affordable housing.
How would you rate the affordable housing crisis in our region?
Well, Connecticut has about the sixth highest median housing costs in the nation. We have about 200,000 households that pay more than half their income. More than half. And if you're talking about renters, you have about half of all renters pay more than what's considered affordable, which is 30% of their income.
It doesn't leave much money for anything else, does it?
No, not at all.
Has the situation been getting worse the last few years?
It hasn't necessarily been getting worse because it was already pretty bad. It's been a problem in Connecticut for at least 30 years, you see that number of what we call cost burden families really moving around the 48-50% of all renter households are paying more than they can afford.
I know that you were sitting here listening to me speak with the assemblyman, and I related that story about that report I did for Connecticut Public TV. It was a full documentary, and we spent an hour and a half on it. We had a big studio audience, the whole thing, and we said, okay, here are the solutions, here are the problems, here are the solutions, what's going to be done? And 30 years later, we're talking about the exact same thing. So what's the fix?
Well, I think first I would say there have been a lot of changes in housing funding policy sort of at the federal level, but we've just come out of about 8 years from the previous administration where there have been a lot of money dedicated, a lot of state funding dedicated to expanding affordable housing. And we have many thousands more units of subsidized housing, but that doesn't solve the problem. That really just sort of tries to slow down the problem. The real underlying problem is our land use regime, which is essentially not allowing multifamily housing outside of our urban centers.
Going to get to that in a moment. Steve, thanks again for being with us. Thanks for holding on. As I mentioned, this is nothing new. And to be clear, our region is not unique. New York and Connecticut, this is happening in many areas across our country. What's the take from Brantford? Does Brantford have enough affordable housing?
Well, that depends really on what you consider to be affordable housing. The affordable housing law dictates the number of deed-restricted units. So a town like Brantford, which is a very diverse town, Brantford has very, very wealthy areas and very less wealthy areas. And we have quite a bit, quite frankly, of homes that would fit the typical affordable housing numbers, but without a deed restriction, it's not counted in that number you would need, that 10% number. So There's quite a bit of housing that is affordable. We have a very high, for example, free and reduced lunch rate in school systems, which we can use to show many people who would fit that criteria live in the town, but we do not have the 10% threshold of deed-restricted housing in the area, and that's caused conflict with the law and proposed projects.
Steve, what's the reaction by residents in the town when they hear from people such as those in New Haven, some of whom say, look, the burbs, the suburbs, aren't doing enough? When they're talking about affordable housing, they're saying, put the affordable housing in the cities and leave us alone, basically, because if you do that, it's going to affect our property values and it's going to affect our schools.
Well, look, we see this on an everyday basis when people who are not really involved in politics and the day-to-day, intricacies of political maneuvering or this law start looking at it, they get upset. When people don't understand something, they get upset. First of all, more than anything else, we have to clarify that affordable housing is not, you hear people say it's Section 8 housing or it's the worst types of people there are. That's certainly not the case. Affordable housing is a lot of working-class people. But there's often a lot of fear because people don't understand what it means. But secondly, this people have neighborhoods, and they've moved to certain neighborhoods for certain reasons, often to get away from other neighborhoods or to live in a certain type of lifestyle. So clearly there's going to be fear when there's a threat of that changing in their neighborhood. I'll give an example in Brantford where we have this law, the affordable housing law, is being used to push a project that may change the demographics of an area. Really, the opposition is because the building itself is a four-story building instead of what was there before, a two-story building, and people are upset it doesn't really fit the neighborhood, which is understandable. But in anger, we see residents do things that are often inappropriate. We had one person recently post fairly homophobic comments online about the Planning and Zoning Commission. They're upset if they don't understand something, and they want to direct that anger at somebody, and often it's a local official or local planning board, who, because of the law, really don't have much say in what affordable housing projects can be approved, especially if the town is under that 10% threshold.
Sean, Steve brings up, I think, an excellent point, because this comes down to many times the fear of the unknown. Are you going to change the character of my neighborhood?
Yeah, what I ask when I hear people talk about the character of the neighborhood is to really put that question back and say, well, what does that mean? What do you mean when you say character? Because I think if we look at a lot of our town centers, and Brantford's included, and all along the shoreline, Fairfield County in general, you do see traditionally a variety of housing types. The centers of our towns that we, when we think of what traditional Connecticut looks like, it's not a subdivision with 2-acre lots or 5-acre lots. It's our village centers. And if you look at them, they're traditionally, that's where you would find rental housing, multifamily housing, even 100 years ago or more. Maybe an 8-unit building, maybe a 3-unit building, more than one story. So I challenge people to tell me what exactly they mean when they talk about character. Are we talking about issues of class? Are we talking about issues of race? Let's talk about it then.
And that, once you get to that point, I mean, that opens up a whole can of worms, as you well know, because you and I were speaking during the break. I mean, when it was proposed to reorganize the schools just a number of months ago, people were furious because, once again, you were messing with the schools. You were messing with the character of a community.
Right. Well, again, I would turn that back to the residents that have those concerns about character and say, well, what does that mean exactly? Does that mean, kids in your neighborhood that come from a different socioeconomic class that look different? And why don't you say that?
Steve, are you seeing any innovative solutions? First of all, Brantford, as I know, is a beautiful town. It's a gorgeous community. Are you hearing or seeing any innovative solution in terms of affordable housing in your community or surrounding towns?
Guilford is looking to be a little more proactive. They have some town-owned property they want to develop as affordable, so that's a good step. I think towns, as part of the hope to get a moratorium, are working on more plans long-term. That's helpful. And also think there's some things with the laws that have been changed or partially changed, and there's more options available. Brantford in particular is in a unique position. A law was passed, I believe, 2017, where mobile home parks now count as part of an affordable housing calculation. We thought that would help Branford, but apparently in the law there was a stipulation that said they had to be resident-owned mobile homes. And unfortunately, no mobile homes are actually mobile home parks are actually resident-owned. Usually the owner owns the unit itself, but not the land it's on. So we're kind of hoping to put some pressure on lawmakers to change that. That will help a town like Branford. But again, we always jump to, affordable housing good and the people who are against it bad. And that's not really the case. On the other side of these affordable housing projects are large developers. They are profit-driven developers. We have to take a look at these neighbors. And I've seen three or four of these applications now where we run to things like racism and class warfare. And people work hard and save up to be able to live in better neighborhoods. And so that fear, it's not just racism or class warfare. They want a better life for their kids, and they're not knowing what's going to happen. And then having laws that circumvent local planning and zoning commissions, it's understandable in some ways. And it's not racism. It's not class warfare. People want a certain life for their families, and they have worked hard for that. So are there innovative solutions for that? I don't know if they're all that innovative, but there are things we can do to make it a fair calculation and a fair way to treat neighborhoods that have worked hard to keep a character intact, not just in who lives there, but the types of homes that are there. If you have a bunch of single-acre zoning going in there with a large apartment complex, changes the character. I don't care if millionaires live in that apartment complex. It still changes the character. So there's two sides to this. We can't just run to the opposition is against affordable housing, against poor classes. It's really not the case. We have to look at it, I think, a little more well-rounded than that.
Very well said, Steve. Sean, you had mentioned before that some changes that you believe that need to be made in Connecticut to really tackle this would be in land use. Could you expand on that a bit?
Well, I think it's really, if we get away from issues of talking about race, socioeconomic class, let's talk about supply and demand. And there was a time when a lot of our suburbs were very open to development in the form of single-family housing. And those towns looked a lot different before then. A lot of them are rural. Mm-hmm. They're not any longer. And that was acceptable. But now we're at a point where many communities are very skeptical about allowing any kinds of new development. But we're in a position where renting has become a much more common option and is often, I think, seen as a stepping stone to home ownership for a lot of families. I think that that's really changing. And Connecticut has more renters now than it's had in a generation. It's about a third of all households are renting. Just a few years ago, it was 3 percentage points lower than that. And we have, in Fairfield County alone, when you look at young adults, which we classify, say, 19 to 34-year-olds, mm-hmm. 45% of them live in their parents' home. Mm. So if we're talking about supply, just strictly looking at supply and demand, to me, that is an indicator that we don't have a healthy housing market in Connecticut. When we don't have a place for our younger adults, and you think back to your own younger days when you were in your 20s and 30s, you're not living with your mom because mm-hmm. you want to. And we know that we have, as you heard from your previous guest out on Long Island, we have a drain. It's very difficult for young folks to make it in Connecticut, particularly in Fairfield County. And housing costs is the largest cost of almost every family budget. If towns are not allowing the kind of development the market wants to see, then the people leave and the price goes up. Mm-hmm. It's a simple supply and demand equation. So my question to a lot of folks, and there's towns that I think get this. If you look at Fairfield around Fairfield Metro Station, they're permitting a lot more multifamily housing. Most of it is market rate with a small set aside for affordable units. And when we're talking about affordable units, we're not talking about, we're talking about folks that may make, for a family of four, up to $90,000. So just to give some context of who we're talking about families that make, for a family of four, somewhere between $70,000 and $90,000. Those are the folks that are living in these units mm-hmm. That fall under the Affordable Housing Appeals Act, which is, our other guest mentioned, which is commonly called Section 830G.
Right. One of the first programs that we did when the full story started last November was the graying of Connecticut, the mm-hmm. fact that the state is simply getting older. the residents are getting older, and kids, in quotes, no offense meant, but they're simply saying, we can't afford to live around here, we're going to go elsewhere, or they simply didn't like the quality. Steve, we have about 2 minutes, 3 minutes left. Before I do, what are you seeing in Brantford in terms of the younger generation? And again, between 19 and 34 years old or so, are they staying in Brantford? Are they looking to rent? Do they want to buy? Are they leaving the area?
Yeah, overall, the Brantford is aging at the rate, if not a little faster, than many other towns in the state. And people, look, many do return. Brantford's a great place to live, so some do, but many don't. We are doing some significant things recently. The First Selectman commissioned a project to look at transit-oriented development around a train station, so there's the idea of doing more condo units, market-rate units, in walking distance to the train station. We're seeing that group not have cars, so that helps as well. So that's a step in the right direction. But yeah, overall, Brantford has, it's a unique town, and many people return back because they love it, but many don't. You know, once they're off to college, we may not see them again. And I think that's reflective throughout the state overall. I think your other guess is correct.
And Sean, from what millennials have told us and from the reports that I've read, many of them don't even want to own homes. They don't want to own condos. They would rather rent. They don't want a car. They want to take public transportation, walk around downtown, and have a much simpler life, if you will, than maybe their parents.
Absolutely. And, you know, I'm not a millennial, but I can really appreciate that.
Neither am I.
Yes. And, you know, and I'm familiar with Brantford Center, and Steve's, what I think really transit-oriented development is what we want to see happen in our state for such a variety of reasons, and primarily the quality of life that people love about Connecticut. And our town centers really are beautiful. So figuring out how to do that in an equitable way that allows it, that they don't become playgrounds just for folks that are, you know, perhaps need to commute into, if we're talking about Fairfield County, commute into Manhattan, these are real actual communities. You know, that's really what I'm concerned about, is that we keep these places living, breathing places that have some diversity. But transit-oriented development, I think it is something we're hearing a lot more at the state level about focusing on some resources on, and I'm all for it. I think it really is the future for the state.
Steve, we have about 30 seconds left. Final thoughts, please.
I think he's right about transit-oriented development. I do think people want to be able to live in a place that is kind of all-encompassing. They're within walking distance to train stations, restaurants, coffee shops, things to do. And I think many towns are working in that way. Brantford certainly is, and hopefully that's going to be a help in part of this affordable housing discussion.
And Sean, final thoughts, please, 30 seconds.
Well, I just want to thank you for the opportunity. I think it's particularly for Fairfield County, this is a really pressing issue for our economy, really, for allowing people to find homes to meet their families' needs and fill the jobs that we have here in Connecticut.
Sean, Steve, it wasn't enough time. I'd love to have you guys come back soon, will you?
Anytime.
Thank you.
Thanks, Steve. Steve Mazzacane, the owner and editor of Brantford7.com. Sean Guillo, policy director at the Partnership for Strong Communities. It's the full story on WSHU. If you want to comment, please leave us an email. We're at tfs@wshu.org. We'll take a break and be right back. It's the full story on WSHU, and we're talking housing in our region, specifically affordable housing. Let's bring in Jonathan Miller. Jonathan is the president and the CEO of Miller Samuel. It's a national real estate appraisal and consulting group. Hey, Jonathan, how are you? Thanks for your time today.
Nice to be with you, Ron.
What's the housing stock in our region looking like nowadays?
Well, I think the fair analysis in the region is it's confused. And the reason it's confused is because there's a disconnect between what you're reading about the economy and how housing is actually performing. You know, historically, housing goes along or leads the economy, but in this case, there seems to be a disconnect. It's very odd. And one of the reasons for the disconnect is that we have a lot of forces at work that are still sort of the way I think of it is related to the financial crisis. We're still in a hangover period.
I have gotten to know a bunch of people over the last few years, boomers, as they age. They are simply saying they don't want the bigger homes, and they're downsizing, or they're renting condos, or they're moving to something smaller. Is that putting a strain on other parts of the affordable housing market?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, when you look at over the last decade, interest rates have been falling steadily, and so I think many people look at it as a gift. The gift of low interest rates means, hey, it's more affordable. But really what it means is that whenever you have falling interest rates, asset prices actually rise. So asset prices have been rising, meaning housing prices have been rising pretty significantly over the last decade in most of the country. And the problem with that is that even though the interest rates are falling, so in theory that takes some of the pressure off of your mortgage payment, wage growth has not been keeping pace with housing. So the problem is it sets up the economy to be more vulnerable in the future, at least the housing economy, when there's an uptick in interest rates. And I don't foresee, although, you know, who knows, but the long-term prognosis seems to be that rates are going to remain low for a while, even if they rise somewhat. And I think the housing market would be a lot better off with higher rates. You know, not what we're having now is unusually low, but, you know, if rates are in the 5.5% on a 30-year fixed, you'd see credit normalize. I don't think people realize that, you know, even though interest rates are falling, mortgage volume for the last decade, aside from refinance booms like we're going through now, mortgage volume has generally been declining despite interest rates falling, which is counterintuitive. And I think one of the reasons is there's just still a lot of concern about the future. Right now, the stock market loves current economic policy, but the stock market doesn't represent the economy. It's a small subset of the economy. And the bond market is terrified that you've had a more than 1% drop in mortgage rate, a 30-year fixed rate, over the last year. And that's because there's a growing concern about the future. And you know, people wonder, hey, why, you know, if rates are falling, that makes housing more affordable. And the problem with that is falling rates actually, in the long run, do not make housing more affordable, because the amount of payment you can afford every month, the portion for principal and interest is smaller. But with the rate, if housing prices don't change, but housing prices rise when rates fall. So it's confusing to the consumer. One more thing on the term affordable housing is, or, you know, how to make housing more affordable, is that affordability, housing affordability, used to imply, you know, more prior to the financial crisis, it used to imply that, you know, it meant like government subsidized or, you know, government related housing. And really what affordable housing means, it's now almost entirely on middle class, you know, relative to income levels in specific, you know, wherever you are, like middle class economic, you know, levels in, say, Manhattan are not the same as they are in Iowa.
Absolutely.
But the idea is that there's a real pressure on middle class housing affordability, and that really has been since the financial crisis.
You know, just hearing you talk about rates, I'm sure there are some brokers and lenders out there right now who are listening to that who are saying, are you kidding me?
Right, exactly. Because everything is, in the banking or mortgage discussion, everything is rate driven. It's all about, you know, shaving 0.2 of a point off of your mortgage or whatever it is, and that makes it more affordable. But if you look at, you know, rates have been falling for 30-plus years, and housing prices have been rising far faster than wage growth. And, you know, wage growth is how you pay for the housing over time as it rises. Literally, asset prices rise in general when you have falling rates. The cost of financing drops. There's an inverse relationship. It's not as if it's doing you, you know, a favor. In the short term, sure. But in the long term, it really, in my view, isn't. And because rates have been so low for so long, that lenders are right now, if you refi and you get a mortgage, I think the typical person feels like the lender, up until the money or the checks change hands at the closing table, feels somewhat like the lender is trying to remove, you know, any possible risk, even at the last moment, like they're not trying to do the loan. And that's because credit tightness has not normalized since the financial crisis. Credit is still unusually tight. And as a result, you know, many lenders from the underwriting scenario are somewhat in the fetal position of just sort of hunkering down and not as aggressive as they used to be. That's why origination has, you know, meaning lending, has been steadily declining for a decade despite the decline in rates. It's so counterintuitive to what you hear in the public domain. And we can see it in the valuation industry. And as a result, you're seeing all kinds of things now that are trying to sort of accelerate or expand mortgage volume, because mortgage rates really haven't been over the last decade. Falling rates have not equated to more sales in housing as a general rule.
Jonathan,
so
I'm just going
to
ask.
The regulators try to remove any pain points, any obstacles to loans going through, in terms of getting the lenders to ease up on their concern about, you know, the future conditions.
Sure. I'm just going to pause you there because we're tight on time. Jonathan, are you looking into whether older residents, the ones whose kids are in college or moved out, are they taking off for other areas of the country where maybe housing is cheaper or taxes aren't as high?
Yes, they are. So one of the byproducts of the SALT tax, which was the job credit, and I forget the specific title for it, but what it, the Tax Cut and Jobs Act, I think it was called, that went into effect January 1st of 2018, that specifically caused problems for the northeastern United States and California, because now there's a cap on your exemption for your property taxes at $10,000, plus what you pay in SALT, which state and local taxes. And so that's dramatically increased the cost of home ownership, and it's more dramatically in the sense as you move high, it impacts the higher end than the lower end. So as a result, we're starting to see an expansion of an exodus out of the tri-state area to other low-cost markets like Florida.
Okay, but with that in mind, Jonathan, I'm wondering if some of them are staying put because their kids are actually moving back in with them because the kids can't afford to get their own place, student loan.
That's another part of the complication of the equation. Because, you know, millennials, and back to the point about, you know, a wage growth versus housing costs, that's the big challenge. And so I think what you're going to see in the Northeast is you're going to see a continuing softening of suburban housing prices at the higher end. Certainly not seeing that at the lower end, but the way I'd characterize this region is, housing prices are softer at the top and tighter as you move lower in price. So those homes, the big homes, the millennial, sort of the upcoming generation, isn't yet equipped to buy them. So that's why for the last six, 7 years in like Westchester, Long Island, Nassau, Suffolk, and Fairfield County. Generally, the pain point in the market has been the high end markets like Greenwich didn't have a housing boom like New York City did, and has had a lot of trouble at the high end.
So can we stay with that for just a minute? Because I'm wondering what the future holds, especially for millennials, because we've had a number of millennials on our program and they have different desires, needs. I don't know what's the right word to use, but they aren't interested in, at least at what they tell us, they aren't interested in owning cars or homes with all the financial burdens that go with them and mowing the lawn, yeah, painting and all that stuff. So they'd rather take Uber or Lyft or rent a condo or an apartment. What are you hearing about that?
Well, so two things. First of all, just as a qualifier, I raised three millennials and a Gen Y, and I still don't quite understand them. But with that being said, that's absolutely true. I think that, you know, you look at, you know, how, you know, it's been over a decade really since the financial crisis. So in their, you know, adult period of, you know, the older millennials' lives, they really have never seen a robust housing market and they have a different impression. So I think that while I agree that the lifestyle change, you know, that they're different than the baby boomers like myself in terms of what they value, they seem to value experiences over things. And that certainly works against, and the new tax law also aids in this, is it reduces the incentives of home ownership, or not of home ownership, but the incentive to, you know, get the next bigger house and the next bigger house and the next bigger house. So the boomers that have the larger houses aren't going to see, you know, a lot more price growth, at least, you know, over the next, you know, 10 years or so, simply because the millennials aren't really as interested in that, like you say. So it's definitely, you know, there's a lot of machinations around this generational change with millennials versus the, you know, who are living with a lot with the boomers, so to speak.
Jonathan, I know your expertise is in studying the numbers and looking at the markets, but looking at all those markets and with your background, do you see a community out there that you look at that in terms of affordable housing should serve as a model for others in our region? Is someone doing something so unique, so special that others should look at it and say, why don't we just copy this?
Well, not to slight anybody that is doing that, at least right now, there seems to be hundreds of efforts, but nothing stands out to me yet. And the reason why it doesn't is because everything is very small bites. It's very fractional to the entirety of the problem. I mean, New York City itself has been trying to create thousands of housing units, but the population or the scale of how many they have to go doesn't really fully, you know, resolve the problem. So at this point, it seems a little, there's just hasn't been a sort of magic bullet, so to speak, that has resolved this problem. And I'm hopeful, but I think it's pretty, at this point, there's no answer.
That's kind of depressing. But I appreciate the honesty. You know, with the time that we have left, and I was wondering about this as I was thinking about our interview today. I'm wondering if more in our region are staying in our region, keeping their jobs where they are, but maybe they're moving a little bit further away where it's somewhat more affordable and simply increasing their commute time.
Oh, I think that's exactly what's happening. I think, and this is sort of not a sidebar, but it really addresses what's happening. If you just look at my, you know, like a company like mine, you know, a small to mid-size professional firm, where we have a certain size of office, and I have more employees now than I did 15 years ago when I signed my lease in Manhattan. And we're going to downsize by 50% because most of my company telecommutes 2 to 3 days a week. And I think, you know, you're seeing more and more examples of this where people are living farther away and they're still able to do everything that their job requires and go in periodically. And it's a long commute, but it's not a daily commute. And I think that's part of the change in the landscape, that people can live in more affordable areas and still receive, you know, or work at higher paying jobs in the immediate vicinity with support.
I only have one minute left, and it's interesting that you say that. I just read an article in the Wall Street Journal the other day where it said that so many people are doing this nowadays, and they're moving to new communities to telecommute. But the problem is that when they move there, they're not bringing the economic benefits to those communities. The headquarters aren't moving with them. They're moving, they're buying the home and so on, but the businesses themselves aren't moving in.
That's correct. And I think that's a real threat to the cities and the taxes they generate and the social programs they provide for. So we're really, you know, with the technology, there's advantages and disadvantages, but the, you know, the affordability of housing is really the driver of this, in my view, and there doesn't seem to be a solution. If you think about it, municipalities don't have the money to subsidize, so they have to create market conditions that encourage affordable housing, and that's very difficult to do.
Jonathan, it was a pleasure speaking with you today. Thanks for your time.
My pleasure, Ron. Really enjoyed it.
Jonathan Miller is the president and the CEO of Miller Samuel, a national real estate appraisal and consulting group. And that's going to do it for our show today. Julie Ferdino is our engineer. Carrie Frank is the digital editor. Our associate producers are Fatou Sangari, Sabrina Garone, Roberto Rojas. J.D. Allen is the producer. Ann Lopez is the senior producer. And Terry Sheridan is our news director. I'm Ron Ropiak. Thanks to you for being part of the Full Story.